What if your legal name doesn't match your birth certificate when you vote? The U.S. House passed a bill last month called the SAVE Act that would require all voters to provide proof of U.S. citizenship. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss which voters would be affected most by this change are Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Dean Judith Darr. Welcome back, Judy.
Always a treat to be here. Thank you so much.
And columnist at the Washington Post's Department of Data, Andrew Van Dam. Welcome, Andrew.
Howdy. Thank you so much for bringing me in.
Well, we're glad to have you here. Judy, what information is currently required to register to vote, and how would this SAVE Act change that?
Thanks, Lucy. Well, currently, the authority to regulate voting is vested in the states and in Congress through the Constitution. And typically, states just require an attestation or a pledge on a form that the person registering is a U.S. citizen. So it's an honor system of sorts. This act would change that by requiring significant and in-person documentation, the two main forms being a birth certificate or a U.S. passport.
Okay. And supporters say this is needed to prevent fraud and keep non-citizens from voting. But how prevalent is that, Judy?
According to most of the research that I took a look at, it's vanishingly rare for a non-citizen to actually vote. There are a lot of allegations that there is massive voter fraud, and there have been studies to interrogate that. But the data suggests that this happens in 0.0001 of instances, and they are pursued by states' attorney generals.
Andrew, opponents of this legislation say it would make it more difficult for some people to register to vote. Can you explain how?
Oh, geez, yes. So you mentioned that you can show two different things there, a birth certificate or a passport. But the problem for a lot of people, and we can guess who, is that your name no longer matches your birth certificate. And that is particularly for people who have married and taken their spouse's surname. And so for those people, they would, in many cases, have to present a passport to register to vote. And you can correct me if I've got slight legal things wrong here, the dean on the call. But in general, something like only half of Americans have valid passports right now. So for half of people, roughly, who have changed their names in marriage, they would have to track down a passport. They'd have to go through that entire passport application process just to register to vote. It's adding an extra barrier for one subpopulation of people.
And Andrew, what can you tell us about how many people across the U.S. have a name that's different from the name on their birth certificates?
Oh, geez. So it is, of course, quite common for people to change their name in marriage. Something like, let's say, roughly more than 4 out of 5 married women have changed their name. Of course, that is much more likely if you are older, when in a lot of cases it wasn't even legal to keep your name after marriage if you are a woman. And it is less common among younger folks. But in general, roughly 4 out of 5 married women are going to have different names and thus run face first into this voter registration requirement.
We got an email from Kathy who writes, in preparation for the possible passage of the SAVE Act, I examined my legal documents and found that my birth certificate was so old that the print was faded and unreadable. So I ordered another copy from the state of Ohio. It came in about 10 days. I also found that I do not have a certified copy of my marriage license. So I went through the process of ordering that from Hamilton County. 4 weeks later, it still has not arrived. The impact on women voters if the SAVE Act passes will be extreme. Judy, that's really interesting that Kathy's trying to be prepared. She's already done all this. this is a big impact in time and sometimes in money, right? Passports cost money to get.
Absolutely. And I applaud Kathy for the logistics that she endured just to be able to exercise her right to vote. So we have to remember that what we're talking about is something that we take for granted and that we have for really hundreds of years been able to exercise without these kinds of burdens. And just to add value to what Andrew said, we do know, as he said, about 80% of women in general have changed their names. And there's about 70 million women in the U.S. who lack the appropriate paperwork. So the burdens that Kathy endured would have to be endured by 70 million women across the country, again, just to exercise their right to vote.
70 million women. Andrew, you mentioned that this affects lots and lots of women. It affects some men, too, although fewer men, as I understand from your reporting, Andrew. Do either of you have any idea? I mean, is this enough people to potentially change the outcome of an election? We've had some pretty close elections the last few years.
I absolutely think that it does. Andrew,
so I can say numbers, but changing the outcome of an election is way beyond me. Though these number, like the number of people involved, is fair, is quite substantial. Of course, it is new registrants, and this may increase its electoral effect. They tend to be very politically concentrated. We find that Democrats are more than twice as likely as registered Republicans, based on our analysis of voter file data, that is all the voter registration data from around the country, we find that registered Democrats are more than twice as likely as registered Republicans to keep their names after marriage. And so there is going to be a slight political tilt to this. It is probably going to, if it has a voter suppression effect, it is going to suppress the votes. It is going to make it more difficult to register if you are a young Republican woman than if you are a young Democratic woman, because you are more likely to have changed your name. You're more likely to have run into this. And in some states, even a marriage certificate may not be enough, depending on how they implement the law. You may need that full passport. So hurdles upon hurdles here.
Do you want to add to that,
Yeah, Chi? Thank you, Andrew. Those are wonderful stats. And I'll just add a few items. You mentioned new registrants are affected, but so are individuals who move, and we're a very mobile society. So it would affect military members. And the law is very specific about the documentation for military members, which is beyond their record of service. Natural disaster survivors who often have to move and have very difficult time accessing that data. Trans individuals who change their names. Rural voters and tribal citizens are also discussed in the law, and they have very specific requirements. And then just one other feature, if I may, Lucy, currently 42 states permit registration online, and the SAVE Act would appear to abrogate that opportunity by requiring in-person presentation of these documents. So it does go beyond the name change and the impact on women to a much broader swath and to create much more logistical headaches for voters. Mm.
Those are excellent points, because so many people do move and want to register where they move to, and so many people are affected by all those different things that you mentioned. We're talking about the Federal SAVE Act, what it would mean for voters and who would be most affected. Do you have questions or comments? Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Judy, we've talked about this a little bit, but can you be a little bit more specific about what's allowed under the legislation as far as other documentation people can bring other than a birth certificate? Or is that something that states will decide on a state-by-state kind of basis?
So the law is very specific about what can be presented as documentation, and it's very extensive in terms of the description. But the bottom line is the main pieces that individuals are going to have access to are their birth certificate and their passport. There's discussion about military members and tribal citizens and what they can provide. And so happy to talk in detail about that. But I think it'd be interesting for us to think about the reason why this law is being advanced and what problem it's trying to solve. So if I may, I know that there's been a lot of discussion over years, particularly perhaps in the last 10 years, about non-citizens voting and massive voter fraud. And in trying to think about this bill, I wanted to look at some of the data. And again, the indication is that the instance of non-citizen voting is very, very small. In fact, just to give you an example, in our state here in Ohio, last year, the Secretary of State reported to the state attorney general an instance of about 600 individuals who he wanted to be investigated for being non-citizens in voting. The attorney general investigated those 600 cases and found that six individuals were actually lawful residents, but they had not gone through, completed their citizen process. And those individuals were indicted on voter fraud. So six out of the 600 that were brought to the attention of law enforcement over a very much larger voting population in which the integrity of the voting system has been established.
And you said those six were lawful residents. And I imagine that could potentially be confusing if you're a lawful resident, but not a citizen, kind of what you're allowed to do.
Correct. In these cases in which the individuals are prosecuted, most of the evidence suggests that they received misinformation, that they didn't understand. In other words, that fraud, which is which requires an intentional element, is just simply absent from the instances in which these individuals, who aren't technically qualified to vote, there's no question, but their intent to interfere with the election, to somehow sway the analysis at the end of the day, just doesn't appear to be part of the picture. So some would say that the SAVE Act is a solution in search of a problem.
We have a caller on the line. Hey, Jeff, thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Hi. So I was wondering if the SAVE Act, what an enforcement mechanism is if Congress decides that a state hasn't been sufficiently compliant in enforcing these requirements. Is Congress claiming it has the right to either reject Electoral College ballots or congressional candidates who are elected unless they feel aren't compliant?
That's a great question, Jeff. Judy, I'm going to throw that one to you.
Okay, I can handle that one. Thank you. The Act provides that the states must administer this new requirement. So again, the Constitution embeds the authority over the time, place, and manner of elections in the states, although Congress does have a role. In this case, an additional burden perhaps for the states is the SAVE Act is what we would call an unfunded mandate. It requires the states to take action, but it provides no funding and no time period within which the states can actually accommodate their voting roles and their processes. And Jeff, you mentioned enforcement. Again, another interesting provision of the SAVE Act is that it creates what's called a private attorney general or a private right of action. So any citizen, any person who feels that there's been a violation of the act has the right to initiate some kind of a prosecution of another individual. And then finally, another burden is that the act creates criminal penalties for election officials who mistakenly register an applicant to vote who has not shown proof of citizenship. So with that burden of a criminal prosecution, you can imagine how tough state election officials will be for fear of their own prosecution in dealing with applicants for voting.
We've got a lot more to talk about, and we will continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, we'll discuss the Trump administration's on-again, off-again tariffs and whether they're affecting your spending and savings. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about the federal SAVE Act, what it would mean for voters, and who would be most affected. My guests are Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Dean Judith Darr and columnist at the Washington Post Department of Data, Andrew Van Dam. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Catherine. Thanks so much for your call. What's your question?
My question is, when I was born, my parents were still having some discussion about what my name should be. And so they left the hospital with me, and my birth certificate just says Baby Heaven. I know I used that document in later years to get a passport. I probably use my driver's license to prove who I am, but I doubt that that would happen today. So could I use my my birth certificate, birth certificate to register to vote with no name on it?
That's a great question, Catherine. Judy, do you have thoughts on that?
Thanks, Catherine. I think that your situation is somewhat common where parents take some time to decide on a name and don't revisit the birth certificate. And it's great that at the time you presented it for your passport that the official was willing to go ahead and process that for you. So, Catherine, under the SAVE Act, the way it's written, you would be fine because you do have a valid U.S. passport. So you don't have to have dual documentation, just one of the listed items. So you'd be fine. But others in your situation, it's really hard to know if they were to present that without their given name, whether an official, especially with this threat of criminal penalty, would be willing to move forward with the registration.
Thank you so much for that question, Catherine. We appreciate that. Judy, you know, we were talking before about how states will have this unfunded mandate and states can make some decisions about what documentation they will accept or won't accept. Does that mean there could be a wide variety of rules among the states in terms of documentation and paperwork and that sort of thing?
Great question, Lucy, as always. The states actually, in some instances, have two systems for their registration because they monitor state and local elections and then federal elections. And just the rubric of laws that regulate those can be somewhat different. So there are different systems. But the idea, of course, would be to harmonize those rules so that when you voted in a general election, you could vote for the federal as well as the state offices. So in that way, states already have changes. The idea behind election law, though, is to create similarity among the states. And right now, they do operate in a fairly similar manner. There's about six or so states that have different ways of proceeding in election verification. But for the most part, we do have a fairly federal system.
Well, you know, we got that email earlier about Kathy, who was trying to track down her marriage certificate. I have to admit, I have no idea where my marriage certificate is. I've never tried to get a new one. It seems like trying to get something like that could be quite a hurdle.
Absolutely, because often they're with religious institutions, churches, synagogues, mosques. They may be in city halls somewhere. They could be back at a time where we didn't have records or certainly digitized records. So I think that's a tremendous hurdle. That's not part of the SAVE Act per se, but that may be the document that you need to access the documents that are required in the SAVE Act, including the passport.
Well, we also got an email from Lee who writes, "My husband and I lived in Sweden about 20 years ago. Neither of us were Swedish citizens. We were allowed to vote in local elections. I can see how people might be confused about voting." That makes sense. I had no idea that that was allowed in Sweden. There's a lot to figure out when you move to a different country. Andrew, you mentioned before that a majority of young women who do not change their names are Democrats, whereas more Republican young women do change their names when they get married. I might be putting you on the spot here, but do you think that could result in less support for this from Republican senators? This is sitting in the Senate right now.
Well, geez, I am not a political consultant, but if I were a Republican senator, I would probably not support something that made it more difficult for Republicans to vote, that disproportionately targeted Republican voters. And more broadly, you know, we are talking about issues of citizenship here, and we have seen a surprisingly large increase in immigrant Americans voting for Republican candidates. And so a lot of the populations targeted by this legislation could be Republican supporters or potential Republican supporters.
Judy, we've talked about how this legislation, if passed by the Senate, which it hasn't been passed by the Senate yet, it's been passed by the U.S. House of Representatives, could create legal hurdles for some voters, mostly women, that would require spending time and money to get a passport or track down this documentation that other voters wouldn't have to spend. Would you expect lawsuits to be filed over this if it does become law?
I certainly would. And this wouldn't be the first time that federal legislation that deals with elections has been challenged on a constitutional basis. So I think that interfering or infringing with the right to vote, as might be perceived by a plaintiff that would challenge this law, is not unlikely to move forward. And Andrew's good point about the demographics of voting also makes this incredibly interesting. And I know that you've covered this topic extensively, but the change in demographics is something that we should think about as we consider making voting more difficult.
Well, I have been talking with Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law Dean Judith Darr and columnist at the Washington Post's Department of Data, Andrew Van Dam. Thank you both so much for your time today and for this important conversation.
Thank you, Lucy, so much.
Oh, geez. Thank you.
Up next, we'll discuss the latest with the Trump administration's on-again, off-again tariffs and whether they're affecting your spending and savings. This is Cincinnati Edition.